You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is... World Anvil is a browser-based world-building platform designed for all world builders, writers and novelists, dungeon masters, game developers, and everyone else. World Anvil keeps your world setting safe and organized, helps you find your characters, locations, plots, timelines, and maps quickly and easily as you write. Then, if you choose, you can showcase your amazing world building to the world, beautifully and interactively, to keep your readers engaged. You can even use our professional tier to build your career, selling access to behind-the-scenes content your readers will love and growing your community. Build your world setting in any genre with over 25 custom-built world-building templates, complete with prompts to inspire your creativity. Allow your readers to explore the public parts of your world in an innovative new way with interactive maps, timelines, and wiki-style articles. Give special access to co-authors, beta readers, customers, or patrons to see exclusive behind-the-scenes content. There's a free version to get started with all of the major features. Guild membership offers you a host of extra options, including comprehensive privacy settings, co-authors, presentation options, and so much more. Join our community of over 800,000 world builders, including professional authors. Take part in competitions and learn more about world building at this fantastic online community. Use the coupon code HANK to get 20% off all 6 and 12 month subscriptions. WorldAnvil.com. I'm a recent convert and I know you will be too. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am super excited to have Carlos Hernandez on the show with me. He's got a phenomenal new book. It's another in the Rick Reardon Presents imprint series. It's called Sal and Gabby Fix the Universe, and it's the second book in the series with these fantastic characters. Welcome to the show, Carlos.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you, Carlos. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
I have a very clear memory. So had an assignment in first grade. And just as a side note, my first grade teacher's name was Mrs. Gross. Like, you can't write this stuff, right? But she was a lovely person, but that was her name, you know. And Mrs. Gross, she had us do a limerick assignment. And when we were done, she liked my limerick so much that I got to read it over the intercom during the school announcements the next day. So I was reading my little limerick to fifth graders, and they had to listen. After that, I was absolutely addicted. I haven't looked back since.
Oh, that is so, so amazing. You know, I like to ask people if they ever received encouragement from an adult when they were younger, maybe a parent or a teacher. Because you know this, as writers, there are some pretty dark and lonely days where you're just sitting all by yourself with a computer or a notebook or however you write. And, you know, there may be thoughts of, you know, self-doubt and all of this that come in. And, you know, invariably, those little encouragements that we received years and years and years ago come back and empower us to to finish the work that we started. And I think some people don't realize just how far those little encouragements can carry people. And it sounds like that is ingrained in your first memory. That's so great.
Absolutely it is. And, you know, I'm extremely fortunate. I had supportive parents. I had a host of great teachers. You know, I could go down a list and give you, you know, all sorts of encouragement that I received, you know, through all of my education and my home life. So I'm extremely lucky. And it doesn't mean that I don't have my anxious days where I wonder how hot I need to get a fire in order to burn my entire laptop. But, right. You know, I can also, you know, look back and be very grateful for all the encouragement I've received.
Oh my goodness! The how hot to burn a laptop is something that we have all asked. Sure. So after the Limerick contest, where did you go from there?
So we'll fast forward a few years, and when I was in fourth grade, I got to read a story on WQSA, which is an AM radio station, or was anyway, in Sarasota, Florida, and my fourth grade teacher also extremely influential in my life, Graham W. Smith. He was a 6'4" former Marine, you know, and so, you know, to a fourth grader, especially, you know, like I was a pretty pint-sized child at the time. Like, you'd think he'd be intimidating, but instead he was a beautiful male role model to have because he was intellectually curious. He never raised his voice. He was just cheerful and curious and intellectual. And, you know, just as a quick example, you know, we were talking about soccer one day, and so he stopped the whole lesson and was just like, well, what's the goal of soccer? And we were like, well, you have to squirm around all the people and, you know, try to get it in the goal. And he's like, no. What your goal is to make a straight line possible and get it into the goal as quickly as possible so you can shoot again for another goal. And, you know, just that clarity, that straight line that he drew to the goal, that was a brain-opening moment. It's like, oh, it's not what we're doing. That's not the goal. The goal is simpler, and this is what we're doing because we have to be in. So, like, it was just like one of those moments where it was just like, this man is really good at problem solving. Well, Mr. Graham W. Smith had in his room something called the crow's nest. Now, this would never fly in today's educational environment, but in the 70s, things were faster and looser. And so in the 70s, if you had a good day the day before and you just like were performing it at top notch, you got to sit at the top of a cabinet in the back of the room and do whatever you wanted. It was called the crow's nest. And so every kid was vying hard to be able to get up on that top cabinet and just like mess around all day long and whatever. So, you know, one day I wrote a story hoping to get up in the crow's nest, and he liked it so much. He had, you know, a way to connect me to WQSA that I was able to read my story, you know, to a radio audience. And it was amazing, you know.
That is so cool. That is so cool. Carlos, I know that you went on to study English in college and receiving your PhD. But, you know, reading your work, I can tell that you are also a science and science fiction nerd. And I mean that with the utmost respect and love. Yeah. Do you remember what your introduction to science fiction was that, you know, kind of opened you up to the kinds of stories that you can tell?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was just an omnivorous reader, and that included science fiction and fantasy. And especially when I was younger, I just didn't make any differentiation. You know, to me, it was just like fiction, nonfiction, science fiction, romance, whatever got thrown in front of me, I would consume. And that came mostly from my big sister, Maria, who was also an omnivorous reader. But like when she was done with the book, I would pick it up and try to read it. And so I was introduced constantly to a wide panoply of different kinds of books. And the ones that I started picking, especially like when I got more into my teen years, were science fiction and fantasy. And it was specifically because I felt like those books had their philosophy right up front. That is, I was reading all of the science fiction and fantasy as basically either using the metaphors of science fiction and fantasy to, you know, talk about philosophy, which I was really into, or they would flat out talk about philosophy, you know, when you were reading Asimov or other, you know, like it's a genre that lends itself to that sort of thing. And so on the myth side, that was more the fantasy side. But the philosophical side was more the science fiction side, and that's what attracted me.
Gotcha. Carlos, did you grow up in South Florida? Is that right?
I guess like middle Florida. So okay. I grew up in Sarasota, Florida. And, you know, I went to school for a couple of years in Tampa at the, you know, the University of South Florida there, finished my education at New College back at Sarasota. And but I've always had family in Miami. So we would, you know, travel all the time to Miami to see them and interact with them. Not all the time. That's an exaggeration, but had a lot of experience with Miami. And so basically in Sarasota, there was a very tight-knit, relatively small Latinx community, but then you'd go to Miami and it would be, you know, Latinx Mecca.
Gotcha. Growing up in that sort of culture, how do you feel like that influences your writing today? Now, with the Sal and Gabby series, it's very obvious. You're pulling from those influences in creating these characters in this world. But maybe if we kind of pull back a little bit to a higher altitude, and you can look at the whole body of your writing, how do you feel like that Cuban influence and the Latinx influence has affected you as a writer?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically like asking sort of like, how has your identity influenced your writing? You know, it's like my identity is so interwoven with Spanglish, for instance, you know, just like having a second language coming in all the time. And just as a quick side note, when I took the GREs, I encountered a word I'd never seen before in English, but I knew exactly what it was because what is a difficult vocabulary word in English was a very simple everyday word in Spanish. In Spanish, when you say you have a cold, you say you have a catarro. But Qatar is like a fancy 19th century way of saying that you have a cold of some kind. But, you know, I encountered Qatar, which was meant to throw me off. And it's like, ha, I speak Spanish, buddy. You know, so I was able to pull that up. And it's like, that's the sort of thing, you know, to me, Spanish has always been with me as a not just as sort of like a second language, but almost like an intrinsic language to the way that I formulate ideas. And it reminds me very much of the way that we think about magical realism. So Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who, you know, is one of the creators of the genre, he told people in interviews, well, I mean, I didn't think I was writing magical realism. I thought I was writing realism. And that is so difficult for me to understand in English and so easy for me to understand in Spanish. Just the formulation, the way that you conceive the world, the epistemology that comes from Spanish, it just feels extremely natural to think about magical realism in that way. And it feels like fantasy when I think about it in English. And having that second way of looking at it is exactly how all of my writing has been influenced by, you know, the Cuban American split identity, you know, of being a part of this American culture. Insofar as like in the 80s, I had like a almost like a parlor trick where I could recite every commercial, like every commercial, just verbatim, you know, and I would just like as a game, I would just like recite commercials at dinner, you know, for everybody to laugh to. So like I was very American in that sense. But also, you know, like I have stories in my family that just they would just sound made up. But in Spanish, they sound a lot less made up and they sound more like hilarious, real things that happened, you know.
Right. One of my best writer friends is German American. He grew up in Germany, speaking German, and then later learned English, and then came to the United States. And as someone who is bilingual, I'm always fascinated with how that works in your brain, how the creative process works when you have these two wells to pull from, for lack of a better analogy. And he says that he writes in English and it doesn't, it's not a struggle for him. It sounds to me like you have a great melding of the two, that they almost become one thing where you're, they bleed into each other. Do you think about that when you're writing the different languages that you can pull from, or does it become one kind of cohesive thing?
Oh, I definitely think about pulling from things to make a cohesive thing. So it's like the one leads to the other. And, you know, the idea is that we have a concept called Spanglish. And, you know, that's what Sal and Gabby is. It is a book that is mostly in English with a little bit of Spanish thrown in now and then. But the thinking is very Spanglish, you know, and sometimes the constructions might seem a little ornate for English. But that's because Spanish, in the syntax of Spanish, is very highfalutin and very fancy, you know, and just like everyday constructions can seem extremely formal if they were transliterated into English rather than translated. So, yeah, it's like it's a very interesting sort of phenomenon where sometimes there's just a better way to say something in Spanish than there is in English and vice versa. And so a lot of times, since I'm rendering mostly in English, I'll think about what can I preserve that has the flavor, the sound, the nuance, the connotation that I'm getting from the Spanish when I think about this idea. Sandra Cisneros, the writer, she has an essay where she talks about the word estrenar, and it kind of means to debut, but debut is a borrowed word in English also. In English, like straight English without thinking about borrowed words, we don't have a great way to celebrate the joy of trying out something that for the first time that you just bought or something, you know, so, you know, you're making your debut with it or something. And she talks about like Spanish builds in a connotation of joy and show-offiness that happens when you put on that new shirt or whatever that is just, it just doesn't exist in English in the same kind of way. And that's the sort of thing that I think about a lot. It's sort of like, well, if I'm saying this idea, you know, that I'm getting from my Spanish, how do I communicate the same flavor in English, the same connotation?
You know, for a lot of high school kids who take Spanish, and that's where a lot of us, you know, get our Spanglish from, is, you know, these high school language classes. Mm-hmm. It's a hurdle for a lot of people to think in Spanish because like you very well put, that the thinking is different. You know, we conjugate verbs differently. We rearrange sentence structure, and you really have to think differently. That may seem like a hurdle, but as a writer, the ability to look at it from both perspectives and to figure out which way is the better way to say it, and then to figure out a way to incorporate those concepts for your reading audience, that just becomes more tools in your toolbox, doesn't it?
Oh, it definitely does. And what it really teaches you is to look at your first language like a second language. I can't tell you how important I have discovered that to be, to re-examine the language, the received language that we have, and remine it for its metaphors and untangle the mess of history that's behind different phrases. And that's what lets you, you know, let burst the lines that you write open and rediscover the magic that's hidden inside really every single word. So an example that I give a lot is the word squirrel comes from the Greek and it means shadow tail. You know, the squirrel is the shadow tail because those fluffy tails, you know, they basically wisp out into shadows and then nothingness at all. It's a gorgeous metaphor that's just built into this word that's waiting to be discovered by an English reader who maybe has never explored the etymology. So re-examining our own language for the beauty, the treasures that are just buried right below the surface is something every writer should be doing.
Carlos, I could talk to you all day about language. this is amazing. But I know that your writing before the Sal and Gabby series has been mostly focused on an adult audience. Before we get specifically into Sal and Gabby, what was the motivation or the entryway to younger people's fiction?
Literally opportunity knocking. And so I had written a short story collection for adults called The Assimilated, Cuban's Guide to Quantum Santeria. Heck of a mouthful there, right? but so I had written this short story collection and Rick Riordan read it and he liked it. And so he showed it to his editor, Stephanie Lurie, best editor in the world, in my opinion. And she liked it. So then we're both in New York. She takes me out for a Cobb salad and says, hey, have you ever considered writing for middle grade? And, you know, between bites, I'm like, well, I am now. I'm thinking real hard right now about doing just that thing. So, you know, I got extremely lucky. What I've been telling people is, you know, I don't get to win lotto. I've used up all my luck to be picked out of the ether by Rick Riordan and, you know, to have this amazing opportunity to write.
Well, and he's got this amazing series that the Rick Riordan presents, yeah, where he's opened up, you know, his platform to other authors, but not just to other authors, but to other mythologies, and really expanding the reading palette, you know, via, you know, his platform that he's built. And we all know that he, with this Percy Jackson series, really, you know, started this thing where he's exploring mythologies from these ancient tales and making them accessible to young audiences in new and vibrant ways. And then, you know, he's opened this up to other authors to explore new mythologies and to new cultures. What is it about the Cuban culture? When you first, when they started talking to you about this, what did you envision would be the things that set your series apart from everyone else's?
Yeah, it's great. So I'll just wanted to say a few things first, that what Rick Riordan did is extraordinary on a number of levels, but just, you know, how they say, you know, don't meet your heroes. Like, you know, Rick, you can meet, I promise you, he is every bit as wonderful as you think he is from reading Percy Jackson or Magnus Chase or the Trials of Apollo. Like, that voice that comes across, he's just as funny and wonderful and caring a person as you would expect the writer of those books to be. So feel free to meet Rick if you get the chance. he's an incredible human being, and, you know, he puts his money where his mouth is. And so he could have written Indian mythology. Like, Disney would have published him and they would have sold very well, but he chose not to because he didn't want to appropriate another culture. So it's not just the fact that, you know, he wanted to, you know, have these stories told. He wanted them to be told by people who come from those cultures. So that, to me, is just the way to do it right, you know.
Well, it shows everybody integrity as well.
Yeah, integrity, knowledge of sort of like cultural awareness. It's just really just the way it should be done. Everyone wants Rick Riordan to write books for the rest of his life, and we all want to read them. But he also wanted to give people the chance to tell stories that he didn't feel qualified to write. And to me, it's just, he just does diversity so well, and he is just doing it right. So he's, I want to grow up and be Uncle Rick when I, you know, I want to be that wise, when I grow up. That said, one of the things kind of like in the idea of cultural appropriation that I did not want to do was specifically Cuban mythology. And here's why. Cuba is so devastatingly colonized that there is little left of the indigenous cultures that were there pre-Columbus. You know, the Taínos, you know, just the native cultures just absolutely wiped out. Like, I don't even want to say decimated, because decimated means one tenth of, which seems like a loss, but it's way more than what tenth that was lost. So, you know, I wasn't going to appropriate Taíno culture or any of the other native cultures there in order to dig the mythology. I wasn't that interested in telling Spanish culture in the way that Spanish culture infiltrated. I didn't feel qualified to tell the African cultures that emerged, you know, from the slaves who were taken from Africa to, you know, work the cane fields. It was just like one of these things where the mythology there was going to be a very complicated hybrid mix of things, and none of which, I'm not sure who would be qualified to tell, you know, a story of mythology in that kind of way. So instead, what I wanted to do is focus on the culture that has combined all of these different elements and made a kind of a new mythology now, and then couple it with science fiction, because here's my thesis: science fiction is one of our new ways of mythologizing.
Yes.
Mythology is basically, how do we explain things that are normally beyond human ken? You know, why does the sun rise in the east? You know, well, there is a god who drags, you know, a chariot across the sky. You know, we use mythology to tell stories, to explain things that are maybe beyond our ken to understand. And science doesn't just explain how the world works. Science posits how the world might work and then tests it through experimentation. But the state of physics right now is that we have a lot of theoretical physics that might not even be testable. Like, if you've read Brian Greene or some of the other, like Lisa Randall, some of the physicists right now, like, they are writing about experiments that could possibly exist, but they're heavy on thought experiments, and some of the ideas of physics right now might never be testable. So that's an extraordinary idea, especially for physics, for a kind of science, that somehow we are creating sciences that don't have experiments to back them up. That means that we are now drifting toward an idea of mythology. That is, we're creating theories of how the world works, but we're not using the scientific method to experiment and determine whether they're true or not. That's a perfect place for a science fiction writer to walk in and say, I'm going to use these for metaphors to describe the human condition.
And what a fantastic exploration that is in the series that you're writing. The characters of Sal and Gabby, where did they come from for you?
So they both were adults in my adult writing. In Sal and Gabby, Break the Universe, Fix the Universe, I have seventh graders who were adults in my Assimilated Cuban's Guide to Quantum Santeria stories. Gabby is a reporter of the cryptozoological. She's exploring weird phenomena around the world. And Sal is a physicist. He's an entanglement. He's interested in entanglement in the story that is in Quantum Santeria. You know, basically the premise was, what if I took these two favorite characters of mine and stuck them in the same middle school in the middle of Miami?
I love it. I love it. Yeah. And these ideas of the cryptozoologic and the quantum entanglement, while they seem to come from different universes, you know, as the story unfolds, they really are more alike than maybe we're comfortable accepting. You know, that the ideas of some of the theoretical physics are closer when we start talking about them than you know, some of the most outrageous tall tales. They're really closer than we realize.
Yeah, and I mean, especially the way that I think fiction writers use them as allegories for the human condition. So to me, the multiverse, you know, dollars to donuts, I don't know that we have many worlds out there in the way that are described, and physics may move away from that very, very quickly, very soon. But as a condition, as a description of the condition of what it means to have the sort of like fractured lives that we have now, and the human desire to know how my life would have been different if I had made this different decision at this one point in my life. See, multiverse is perfect for talking about that what if situation. So to me, it's a great way to leverage this scientific idea that has a kind of credulity built into it right now, because we're so convinced by science in the same way people once upon a time were convinced by the mythologies that they lived by, that we can use that now to explore deeply the emotions behind those facts of human life.
Carlos, and these are obviously ideas that you have been working on for quite a while, and things that you've been thinking about in your fiction. When taking these concepts and trying to communicate them, you know, to a middle grade audience or young adult audience, what were some of the challenges that you ran into, or was it as much of a challenge as you maybe, you know, were worried that it would be?
So let me tell you, the kids are all right. My experience in going to middle schools has been that kids are super smart. They ask all the same questions of writers that the adults do. They'll basically ask, you know, what's your writing process like? How can I do, you know, they'll ask all the same questions that adults do. They'll also ask you what your favorite dinosaur is. And that to me is a feature, you know, it's basically it. Like, yeah, it's just, it's so great. It's just kids, like, you know, if you saw the new Spider-Man movie Into the Spider-Verse, you know, with that, and it was so great, but like, you know, kids know that they watched it. They had no problem with that. And to me, it's like, we have so permeated the zeitgeist with these ideas of physics and many worlds that at this point, you know, second graders and third graders are already more or less equipped to deal with it. I know it for a fact, because I've visited elementary schools where kids have already at second and third grade listened to and absorbed the concepts of the book. So it's like, it's not that hard. Honestly, like, some of the challenges that I found is sort of like, well, you know, if you've been around a middle schooler, you know that they are not the cleanest mouthed species that exists on the face of the earth. And yet I'm trying to communicate, you know, in a way that feels realistic and authentic to said readers of middle grade fiction. And so, you know, coming up with my own custom-made bespoke curses that will cut ice with Disney but seem, you know, authentic, at least in the world that they're coming out of, was some of the greatest fun, but definitely a big challenge as well.
Carlos, I love the series. I love what you're doing. This is the book two in the series. Will we see more stories from Sal and Gabby?
So I'm not allowed to say some things yet. So that's a big clue that I can give you right now. I'm working on another novel right now that doesn't have to do with Sal and Gabby, about rats that hire the son of an exterminator family in order to eliminate the newest resident in the sewers of Manhattan, i.e. a dragon. So that's my latest endeavor that I can't speak about. And, you know, other things I might be able to speak about in a future date.
Incredible. I love it. Carlos, if we're going to put links to Sal and Gabby Fix the Universe, which is the second book, also the first book in that series, Sal and Gabby Break the Universe. I'll put a link to those as well. Two phenomenal books that you need to have on your shelf for your enjoyment and for the younger readers around you as well. Carlos, if people are just learning about you and want to dig into all the great stuff that you're doing, is there a place where they can connect with you online?
Probably the best place is my Twitter feed at Write Teach Play. That's WRITE Teach Play. So, yeah, look for me on Twitter. I have a website. I should maintain it more. I promise I will, you know, someday. You know, I'm probably lying to you. So, check me out on Twitter.
Excellent. We'll put links there to everything. Congratulations on the book launch, and we can't wait to see what comes next from you. Thank you, Carlos.
Thank you so much.
Authors, I have a fantastic new service to tell you about. It's called PubSite. PubSite is a service to help you build your very own website, your home on the web, where you can promote your work and give your fans a place to connect with you. PubSite is a website platform that allows every author, regardless of budget, to have a great-looking professional website. Developed by the book marketing professionals at FSB Associates, PubSite is the new easy-to-use DIY website builder developed specifically for books and authors. Whether you're an author of one book or 20, or a small publisher, PubSite allows you to build, design, and most importantly, update your website pain-free. No need to be dependent on a designer or webmaster to make a small but costly change to your website. Save the money and do it yourself. PubSite is the best platform for authors because it's a book-centric platform. PubSite was built just for authors and small publishers. Every design, feature, and layout is book-centric. They have customized designs for you to use. It's easy to build. No coding or HTML is necessary to create a stunning, professional-looking website with all the features you want. Get a custom domain name, yourname.com. It's simple to update. You can add all of your books, add a blog and a book tour, sell from any retailer, manage your email list and social media, and even do e-commerce. build your website with a 14-day free trial, then pay just $19.99 per month, which includes hosting. And we offer packages starting at $499 to set up the website for you. Pub-site.com, the place to help authors find their home on the web.